I really appreciate the title on this, especially the BS abbreviation.
Yeah.
I just kept reading this and was like, oh yes, bullshit predicts attitudes about abortion. Everybody, and welcome to another episode of In Plain English. I am your host, Jamie Moffa, and today we're going to be talking about the paper Benevolent Sexism, Attitudes Toward Motherhood and Reproductive Rights, a Multi-Study Longitudinal Examination of Abortion Attitudes by Yanshu Wang et al. Here to talk about this paper with us is our expert, Abby, from Political Psych with Abby. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name's Abby. I run a YouTube channel called Political Psych with Abby, and I have a master's degree in political psychology, which I guess for at least podcast purposes makes me qualify as an expert. I also do social science work in my day job, and I try and apply political psychology stuff to some activism stuff I do as well.
That is really cool. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And then our guest for this episode is Rebecca. Rebecca, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Rebecca. My undergrad is poli-sci, and after that I did journalism. I was a freelance journalist for a little over 10 years.
So without further ado, Abby, would you like to get into the paper?
Yeah, sure. So basically, this is a paper examining the effects of different types of sexism on abortion attitudes. And the sample that this is specifically looking at is in New Zealand, but it's fairly similar to research that's been done in other places. But I really like the methodology on this one, and I like the writing, so I figured this one would be a good one to talk about. Basically, it's looking at two different types of sexism. Those are hostile sexism. That's the sort of like just woman hating or woman disparaging type of sexism that people are like very familiar with. That's very, very obvious. And then the second form of sexism is benevolent sexism, which is abbreviated BS, which is my favorite acronym in all of psychology. And what that stands for is that's benevolent sexism, which means attitudes towards women that seem good, or in other words, benevolent, but are actually still limiting or constraining to women. Something like the idea that women are more pure or women are more caring could be benevolently sexist, because that's not inherently insulting, but actually holding those attitudes and holding men and women to different standards on those attitudes can limit women, and actually something that I think is under-examined literature also limit people who are not women. You know, patriarchy is bad for everyone is always my thinking about this. So then we're thinking about these two things in the context of specifically views on abortion. And I actually went into thinking about them in terms of views on abortion because I was teaching a class to a group of very talented high school students last summer, and in my first class, I was like, hey, are there any topics you specifically want to cover? Do you have any questions? And they're like, are we going to cover abortion? Because Roe v. Wade had like just been overturned at that point, I think. Or possibly that was like right after it had been leaked that it was going to be overturned, but it hadn't. I don't remember the exact timeline, but that sort of thing. And they were like, are we going to cover abortion? And I'm like, I actually hadn't planned on it, but oh God, I really have to. It was difficult because I had to figure out how to cover it in an appropriate way for like the age group I was working with. Fortunately, this was like a class at a university, so I got more leeway than you would like teaching in a public school. But, you know, this article is one of the things that I decided to use and that I researched. And then I made a YouTube video based on this article and some other articles about the topic. But that's sort of how I found this article and how I got interested in it. In terms of the article itself, it has two core studies to it. The first one is looking at benevolent and hostile sexism and also examining them over time with abortion attitudes to figure out, okay, does having benevolent or hostilely sexist attitudes come before having really anti-abortion attitudes? So is it more likely to be causal, right? You can't necessarily draw a complete causal conclusion there, but you can draw more from these sort of time lag studies than you could from something that's just purely correlational, right? And what they found is that benevolent sexism correlates to opposition to both elective abortion and traumatic abortion, but I should explain what those two terms mean. Elective abortion is basically the woman doesn't want to have a kid or the person doesn't want to have a kid, which I should clarify, in my view, completely legitimate reason to get an abortion. Nobody should have a kid they don't want to have. But that is, for a lot of people, sort of separate in the way they think about the issue than traumatic abortion, which are a lot of the instances that you'll see certain states or governments making exceptions for. So things like rape or the health of the mother, that kind of thing. So it's not asserting that the abortion is traumatic. It's that the abortion is sort of tied to an additional trauma or an additional potential for harm of continuing the pregnancy or was caused by a trauma. I should also mention that they didn't really find effects of hostile sexism, but that other studies have found effects of hostile sexism, especially on elective abortions, which probably has to do with like the idea that people mentally tying in elective abortion with promiscuity and with feminism, both of which are sort of triggers for specifically hostile sexism. But why would you ask, okay, why would benevolent sexism be a reason why people would object to abortions, specifically traumatic abortions, but also elective abortions? The reason why it's probably so tied to traumatic abortions specifically is what's examined in the second study. I should say that the second study has a very different sample than the first study and is also, I believe, I'd have to check, but not time lagged in the same way. Yeah, it's not time lagged in the same way. So the first study is a pretty representative sample of the New Zealand population. They have a national attitude survey. A couple countries have these and they're super useful in political psychology research. The second study, their sample is basically college kids, which is a very common sample for used in social science research because it's the sample you have access to. And it can be incredibly useful because it's not super resource intensive, but it's also important to have a sample that's not just college kids, right? But it still can give us insight into this one little thing, which they weren't able to examine as part of the larger study, which is, okay, but why? And the theory they come up with going into sort of the second section is, well, maybe it has to do with attitudes towards motherhood, because one of the really core things to benevolent sexism is this idea that like a woman's ultimate value and purpose in life and the thing that she will be really good at and is really important to her is having kids and having a family. And typically also doing that with a man, but the study is a little less focused on that. And there's obviously nothing wrong with having a kid, with having kids and having a family and that sort of thing. And like, that's something I probably want to do someday. But having that be put up on a pedestal as like a woman's ultimate purpose in life has these really harmful effects, as we see in this study, because we see that attitudes towards motherhood correlate very strongly towards opposition to traumatic abortion cases. Yeah, and part of this is basically because these sorts of attitudes towards motherhood include the idea that a woman should be willing to do anything for her children, including like suffer for them. And obviously, like, parents can be expected to sacrifice some things for their kids, but there's a difference between that and what we're looking at here, which is in a lot of cases, women suffering for something that is not a child. And also in many cases, doesn't even really have a chance of a life. So that's a very different sort of situation there. Plus there's this assumption that also comes in with elective abortions that no woman in her right mind would actually choose to get an abortion, because there's this concept that because like the ultimate of positive womanhood is motherhood, no woman would choose to not be a mother unless she's being coerced, essentially.
Yeah, which you can like really see the sexism in that attitude.
No, it's all incredibly condescending and incredibly paternalistic, I think is one of the things that really plays into it. And I'm not sure if it's this study or another study that I read for the video that was talking about how this is maybe one of the reasons why a lot of anti-abortion activism has historically focused on going against abortion doctors rather than women who are specifically seeking abortions and punishing the doctors, because I think that the women aren't necessarily seen as responsible. But I mean, we see that a huge fraction of the suffering in these situations is borne out by women, right? By women who are seeking abortions. So it's not like this is really a protective effect, but it does sort of affect anti-choice activism and like the shape that takes, right?
This came up recently with relatives, and I think one of the things that was interesting, I'm really interested by how you describe the lack of choice that is or agency that's allowed the women in the situation, partly because I've seen it, I know the rhetoric that you're referring to. And yet one of the things that a relative said recently was, well, you know, if you're choosing to have sex and if you're choosing not to use birth control. And I thought, well, that's fascinating, because there's a lot of assumptions in that too, that people have access to it, that everyone is having, there are people who are not having sex voluntarily. And it's an interesting contrast, because it's saying, okay, you have agency for getting in this situation. We're going to hold you responsible for being here, but we're also not going to hold you responsible enough to make the choice. Like, I feel like the rhetoric is consistently inconsistent, if that makes sense. It pivots with convenience.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, and so this is just me theorizing off the existing literature here, but I would say that some of that probably has to do with the fact that sort of the attitudes towards sex specifically and like choices around sex has more to do with the sort of hostile sexism construction, which doesn't necessarily treat women as in need of protection in the same way, but instead judges them for their choices very harshly, especially for sexual choices, especially for any choices that could be seen as remotely promiscuous. And also there's this really, really intense desire in the anti-choice movement to dichotomize the sort of woman who gets an abortion and motherhood, even though I'm not sure if it's the majority, but like a huge fraction of women who get abortions already have at least one kid. A lot of them are already married or in monogamous relationships, but there's still this, like, the image of the person who seeks an abortion in the mind of someone who is anti-choice is young, is childless, is promiscuous. And that's the sort of the hostile sexism stuff is the promiscuity element, right? But then you come in with the young element and the potentially having a child element. And then that triggers the benevolent sexism thing of, oh, well, but they just need to be guided and protected, and they could have a child. They could fulfill this like ultimate purpose in life, right?
Yeah. And I think also in areas where there's a lot of sheltering and a lot of, I don't even quite know how to describe it, but we've had neighbors that have kids in college that don't know proper words for body parts. And so there's not an acknowledgement in this benevolent way of, there's kind of this bubble of everybody's safe if you're like, I don't know.
I totally get what you mean. It's like this putting innocence and purity up on a pedestal and like sort of never treating women like adults.
Right. And that does not allow for one of the big things with abortion, or the carve outs, is often for rape and incest. But if you don't admit that those things happen, because we're all doing so well at protecting ourselves and stuff like that, I don't know if that's benevolent or hostile, but it's like, it's just this weird, weird mishmash of all of it.
There is this, I think that purity culture plays into it hugely. And I think that purity culture has a lot to do with benevolent sexism, which is, I think, why a lot of women end up endorsing it, because it's usually easier to get women to endorse benevolent sexism than hostile sexism, right?
Yes. Yeah. And if you deny these things happen, if you then it's okay, well, you know, if you stay safe and if we protect, if you allow us to protect you and if you stay there, these things don't happen. We don't need to deal with them.
And there's definitely a correlation, I think, for a different study that I read for a different video between benevolent sexism and victim blaming in instances of rape and sexual assault. So, yeah, no, there is a reluctance to admit that these things happen. And then on top of that, a reluctance to admit that these things happen to the women that you are mentally putting in your, not your, but, you know, a hypothetical person's good woman category, right? There's, if we're going to go all classical Freudian whatever on this, it's a lot of Madonna whore complex stuff, right?
I was going to bring up or ask, have you read anything about how these like benevolent versus hostile sexism attitudes break down and apply to like Black women or Indigenous women and how that's different from how they apply to like white women?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of literature to suggest that a lot of the time, especially I think by white people or by institutions, white women are more likely to be treated with benevolent sexism relative to women of color, and women of color are more likely to be treated with hostile sexism. Obviously, neither form of sexism is good, but it does have implications sometimes when it comes to like court sentencing and that kind of thing. There is a really interesting study about that. I'm not remembering the exact details or like what charge they examined, but they did find that women of color were definitely treated differently than white women were. So yeah, there definitely is like a racialized element there too. Plus, I mean, if you're looking at like alt-right movements that are also, you know, incredibly, incredibly racist and incredibly anti-Semitic, you know, there are women in those movements and they would tend to be, I mean, some of them would probably also be hostilely sexist, but many of them would be very benevolently sexist. And benevolent sexism, well, bad, does have a certain allure to some women and so may draw some women into, you know, very right-wing movements.
Would you say that that's the whole, the tradwife movement that...
Yeah, I mean, some of it is hostile sexism because a lot of these women really hate other women and to some extent themselves. Yeah, and like a lot of the like slut-shamey stuff, that's like, that's very hostile sexism, but the like, my ultimate purpose is to have like a ton of kids and be loved by my husband and that kind of thing. Like that's very, and that's what every woman should want. That's very benevolent sexism too, right?
You gave an excellent overview of the paper, but I kind of wanted to go like, you know, the into the first experiment and then into the second experiment in terms of like, how actually did they go about like relating these attitudes of hostile and benevolent sexism to attitudes of abortion? And like, can you go more specifically into how they then hypothesized and set about providing evidence for this like causal direction of like benevolent sexism comes first and then influences abortion attitudes?
Oh, yeah, totally. To measure the hostile and benevolent sexist attitudes, it's they used the ambivalent sexism inventory, I believe. So basically, they asked people their attitudes on various things that are connected to benevolent and hostile sexism. So we would get things like, for benevolent sexism, it would be how much people agree with things like, many women have a quality of purity that few men possess, or for hostile sexism, something like women seek to gain power by getting control over men. And then it'll be multiple questions of that sort of type. And then for abortion attitudes, they actually only asked two questions about it. Legalized abortion for women, regardless of the reason, how much people supported that. And legalized abortion when the woman's life is endangered was the second one. That would have been their measure for a traumatic abortion. There would be the woman's life being in danger. Some studies define it more broadly than that, but that would just about always be included. Yeah, this one, I think they probably weren't able to, in the first study, ask quite as many questions because they were part of this, like, you know, national study. Trade-offs, sample size versus number of questions you can ask. So, and then they asked, I think, basically the same questions a year later and tried to figure out which one sort of led into the other ones.
Okay, so that's the like cross-lagged, is that it's saying...
Basically allowing time to pass and then asking additional questions.
I had kind of a follow-up question. So somewhere in the paper, it said that like attitudes on abortion are relatively stable. like people's attitudes don't change that much year to year. So I was kind of curious then, is it just that they have a large enough sample size that they can see a small shift?
That would be my guess. I'm going to be honest, I haven't gone super deep on the stats in this paper. I will admit that if I have a weakness as a social scientist, I'm not incredible at statistics.
Do they go into the possibility that like hostile sexism is less correlated with attitudes towards abortion because people who hold like hostilely sexist attitudes are more likely to just start out with like negative views towards abortion? And so there's no more down to go. They're already there.
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah, because that's something I was thinking, is that like I would think that possibly hostile sexism would be like just completely incompatible with any like positive views of abortion. And so they would already be like, no, that's bad, versus like benevolent sexism might also be like, you know, gateway sexism. And so it would be more likely that they're starting out with like neutral to positive views about abortion that then go downhill as they become more sexist over time.
I wonder, I feel like they might have lightly referenced that in the area where they talked about traumatic versus elective, but I'm having trouble finding it.
I mean, they don't seem to focus heavily on it because their main thing is talking about, you know, how this is probably caused by attitudes towards motherhood. Also, I think it's important to note that there's very few people who have just hostile sexist attitudes. Yeah, that's quite uncommon. I mean, I'm not going to say it doesn't exist. I guess like incels are a thing. But even then, like, I feel like there's some women they put up on a pedestal. They just consider them unattainable for themselves, right?
So that is a good point to highlight, is that these things kind of go together.
Oh, typically, yeah. Especially in men. In men, there's a very heavy correlation between benevolent sexism and hostile sexism. Typically, women don't have that much hostile sexism. I mean, it's a thing, but benevolent sexism definitely seems to be higher in women than hostile sexism. Also, there's this whole thing of a certain amount of benevolent sexism is unfortunately sometimes found attractive by women looking for relationships with men, right? Because there's like, oh, I want a guy who's going to open the door for me and pay for dinner and all those sorts of things, right? But there's this, in men, really heavy correlation between hostile sexism and benevolent sexism. So I'm not saying every guy who insists on paying for dinner is going to hit his girlfriend, but there is unfortunately a correlation there between benevolent sexism and hostile sexism.
If you're with this sort of person and you're having sex with them and you end up pregnant either because of birth control failure or like whatever other thing happens, like this guy's probably going to try to exert some pressure.
Actually, I talk about this. I did a video on the psychology of dating and not dating across like partisan lines and ideological lines. And one of the big ones for me that I highlighted in the video is that like it's completely reasonable as a woman, or I guess, you know, anyone with a uterus who has sex, you know, predominantly with men, it's very reasonable to want your partner to be pro-choice because things happen, right? And it's important to have a partner who's going to be supportive of your choices, right? That's important even if you are in a relationship where you do want kids, right? Because things happen medically, right? Mm-hmm. That can necessitate abortion. You know, it's not an infrequent occurrence. And it's something that like, you know, the anti-choice side of things really doesn't want being talked about, right? Because yet again, there's this dichotomization of like good mothers, you know, and like basically sluts in their mind, right? So I think it's really important to talk about like the situations where, you know, women do want kids, but they're going to have, they might need an abortion anyway, as, you know, care for a miscarriage or because there are serious, you know, defects or health risks or any of that kind of thing, right?
I think there's a case right now, and I'm looking up to double check the organizations. It's a lawsuit against KU Med Center and the Freeman Health System in Kansas City. So I guess one's located in KCK and one in KC Mo. And it's a woman who had a very much wanted pregnancy, and something went wrong. And because of the laws in the situation, she not only lost the child and had serious immediate health effects, but she can't have children in the future, which I think is one of the ironic things about benevolent sexism, because it idealizes motherhood, but improper healthcare can be preventative of.
Yeah, no, this is absolutely a thing. Like, I personally know someone who probably wouldn't have been able to have their second kid, her second kid, if it wasn't for, you know, getting an abortion for an ectopic pregnancy, right? You know, this stuff is, you know, I mean, obviously it's very important for people to be able to get this stuff in a situation where they just don't want to have a kid. But it's also really important for this to be available for the people who do want kids, because it makes it safer.
Personal experience, because I haven't read a whole lot about that, but it seems like that fits in. It seems to be people who have like a very, who often people who have not experienced what they're condemning and don't seem to be able to put themselves even temporarily in another perspective. So XYZ has worked for them and they don't know, or don't know they know somebody. And so if they don't know it firsthand, it's not happening, it's fine. So if someone doesn't personally know someone who's been through this, their parenthood experience and healthcare experience has been positive, they seem to have a really hard time wrapping their head around the fact that that's not the case for everybody.
Definitely think that that's the case. And there's, you know, coming back around to the benevolent and hostile sexism thing, there is like a lot of the time, if like a right wing politician or something is being called a sexist, they'll be like, no, I have a wife and a daughter and I love them and all that. And the thing is, I'm not saying they don't. They do probably love their wife, their daughter, all that kind of thing. But those people are in their, you know, their little mental circle of benevolent sexism, of protection, right? A lot of the time, I think that they will conceptualize anyone who is not exactly like that, you know, sort of outside that category, right? And won't necessarily empathize with them in the same way, right? Like, sure, you know, learning from the experiences of your family and your friends and stuff is good, but like, I don't want you to care about women because you have a wife and a daughter. I want you to care about women because they're people.
We're kind of circling around this idea of motherhood, which gets at the second experiment in the paper. And so if you could talk a little bit about that, and then I have a question specifically about the sample, because I think it relates back to the issue of experience and inexperience, them being, you know, college students.
Yeah. So basically in that one, they're looking at the relationship between benevolent sexism, attitudes towards traumatic and elective abortions, and attitudes towards motherhood. And that's measured on the attitudes towards motherhood scale, which includes things like a woman is not a real woman until she becomes a mother, and a woman who doesn't want children is unnatural. Yeah, basically they find that attitudes towards motherhood are like a really big contributing factor towards attitudes towards elective and traumatic abortions.
Oh, well, I think one of the things the study mentions is attitudes towards motherhood. And all my friends and relatives who've gotten pregnant have been surprised. They love their kids. They're happy with it. But there's always, always, always surprises. I have a friend who struggled with high blood pressure during her pregnancy, like dangerously high blood pressure during her pregnancy. I've had, you know, friends who've had to move shortly after. Just, there's just always surprises and there's twists. Not everyone comes home and has like the Instagram experience. Even, you know, no matter how much you love your kids, there's those times, you know, there's diaper blowouts. And I think part of this idealism and benevolency can, even in the, you know, like you, I support pro-choice, but if you're not, it can be a really, you can go in prepared and be like, okay, I need to, you know, give myself grace and space afterwards. I need to be aware I might not be able to move as easily, you know, after birth or something like that. And you can prepare for that if you're informed. If you're not informed, there's like some really nasty surprise, you know, like diaper blowout surprises waiting for you on the other side. And it doesn't mean you don't want to do that, but I'm always a fan of informed choice.
Yeah, no, I think that is really important. And also, like, why coming back to it again, right? Like why this benevolent sexism isn't even good for women who do want to spend at least part of their time occupying those more traditionally feminine roles, right? Even if someone wants to be a stay-at-home mom, which is a totally fine thing to want to be, this stuff is not good for them.
Oh, absolutely not. Because like, I don't know anyone who has a kid under five who, you know, feels like they're on top of their house and stuff like that. But I think, you know, they're, who doesn't feel like life is a little bit chaotic, but the tradwife social media we talked about earlier, I don't think it's realistic and it's cloaked in a lot of the same language. And so people who are choosing to have families and enjoying their families are still feeling like they're not measuring up to what isn't a real realistic expectation. And we, you know, we talked about how some people who there's a sizable amount of people who have abortions or consider abortions who have kids. And part of that's, you know, managing their families and what they can handle. And one of the things I noticed when we started talking is that the definition of traumatic does not take into account mental health.
The definition for this article definitely doesn't. I'm not going to say that no definition does because I haven't, like, I'm not an expert on exactly how these things are defined. Yeah, I think there might be a few places where they have something about mental health in the law, but nowhere in the U.S. that I'm thinking of.
There doesn't seem to be any awareness of like postpartum depression or families trying to be realistic about what they can handle economically, or even just not everyone wants to have, toddlers are a lot of work. Not everyone wants, some people want big families, but maybe want to space their kids out a little bit. And all of those are choices that I feel like they should.
Yeah, no, I think that there is no acknowledgement of like the actual reality of womanhood or motherhood specifically in benevolent and hostile sexist attitudes, because it has these, you know, very specific, very idealized roles that no one's ever going to fit perfectly, right? And that comes back around, right? If we're talking about benevolent and hostile sexism generally, that comes back around to why it hurts everyone, right? Because no man is going to fit the ideal idea of what a man should be under patriarchy, that kind of thing. And then, of course, people who don't fit under the definition of either men or women, they're obviously not served well by patriarchy either.
Yeah, there's a lot of boxes we're trying to put people in with these mindsets, I think.
Yeah.
So I think this is getting at, so there was an odd email conversation I had in the lead up to the many times canceled recordings of this podcast, which was that the other person who is supposed to be on this podcast, who unfortunately couldn't, mostly because he is in Europe and scheduling was incredibly difficult, he had looped another person into the discussion who he felt would be more like qualified or whatever. But this person responded had read the paper and responded, and he was like, I don't really know what to say about this. And one of his questions was like, what are we supposed to do? Treat women worse? So like, obviously this is not the right takeaway, but I kind of like wanted to address that in terms of like, okay, people could bad faith like say that that's the takeaway, and like, why is that not correct?
I've gotten that in the form of a YouTube comment like 5 times by now, and also probably another 5 from Reddit, like 1 or 2 from Instagram. Like, I've gotten this before, and it's something I go into more depth about in my general video on benevolent and hostile sexism, which the people who leave those comments do not watch in full, and then they leave the comment anyway. What I was gonna say is, no, my argument is treat everyone well, but don't make it conditional on gender roles. Yeah, the thing I say in the video on benevolent and hostile sexism is, getting over this isn't about not opening the doors for women. It's about opening the door for a man, right? Like, it's just about, you know, open the door for everyone and open the door for a woman, even if she's not dressed well or conventionally attractive, right? It's about taking away the carrot and stick that tries to force people into little boxes, and instead making it just to be about being a good person and having what being a good person is be independent of whether you're a man or a woman or something else, right?
I've seen people discussing, we have a feminist household, so we split all our bills 50-50, and my pregnancy is being considered my expense, and so he's not contributing at all to the checkups and the delivery and or sometimes even the bottles and the, and it's, I think it's that same, you know, oh, well, it almost feels like punishing people for feminism. It's that kind of twisting the language and reversing it. Like, I'm just fascinated by that phrasing. Well, are we supposed to treat them worse? And I think there's definitely people who are like answering that with a yes and an exclamation point. There we go.
If it's a couple having a kid together, right, it's their kid. So they both have responsibility for the expenses involved, right?
That attitude feels like when, you know, a kid wants a puppy. And so the parent is like, well, it's going to be your responsibility. Imagine going to your wife and being like, well, if you want a child, it is going to be your responsibility.
God, that would be so weird and awkward, like having one parent be like, not really a parent. That's so strange.
But I totally think that that's how some people view it. And that's definitely like a traditional model of parenthood. Like, I think about my grandparents. I don't think my grandfather did a lot of parenting.
My friend who had high blood pressure with twins, her husband decided that they would move towards the end of her pregnancy and he would take a new full-time job that involved 40 hours a week of training, and seemed to kind of outsource a lot of his role to his mother. And you can imagine how that went. From the moment I saw the title of this paper, I was like, benevolent sexism. That's just such a fantastic term, because the language was always, there was a lot of, you know, I'm the provider language and well, I'm getting someone to help you. And it was again, always couched in this language of care, but that doesn't help when you're, you know, feeling like you're drowning with two, you know, and your partner's not there. And I really, really appreciate what you said about how, like, this is not good for guys either. All these boxes, like, keep people from having the full range of human experience.
Yeah, no, it's totally true, right? Obviously, in some relationships, there's going to be some discrepancy in like the amount of time that each person spends with the kid. And also, I think, you know, there is unfortunately this like economic pressure, right? Where both parents can't necessarily take the same amount of time off or really enough time off, right? So that's like a whole thing. But I think that it is under-considered and overly uneven in a lot of cases, right? But I also think that there's this pattern that I've observed in some people around me of like treating men like they can't do anything with kids, right? And I find that so, I think that that's, you know, if you do that, right, then they're not going to learn, right? It's not going to get better. You're not going to have a true equality, right? You know, I think people just sort of assume, right, that like women are the one who's are better with kids. And that's just not always true, right? But we so have a society that's like built around that idea when it doesn't have to be, right?
I wonder what it's like to be a boy or a man who's looking forward to parenting and hear benevolent sexism, you know, parenthood is great, kids are great, and then also feel shut out of that when it's always motherhood.
I was going to say, I mean, obviously I can't speak to that experience because I'm a woman, but like, yeah, no, I think that is a thing, right? When I was like making the video about benevolent and hostile sexism and abortion attitudes, it was difficult figuring out like exactly what language to use, right? Because I wanted to be very inclusive, but I also had to talk about the fact that like, from like a psychological perspective, these are like gendered roles. So I have like a whole like probably a minute long digression about why I use the language I use.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, sexists are not considering the nuance of like gender identity.
Abby, you've talked about the importance of supporting choice, including parenthood, and that including policies that support parenthood. And I just was thinking, sexism seems inherently short-sighted and narrow. It doesn't consider who's involved and it doesn't consider needs outside a very narrow range. And that in so many aspects of the conversation that we're having, not just the people are put in boxes, but the whole situation. And it just feels really confining.
Yeah, no, I totally think that. And I think part of it is that the world is a very complicated place, right? And people have this desire for it to be more ordered and less complicated. And that's completely understandable. We literally can't keep everything in our heads, but that can lead to, you know, constructs like sexism and that sort of thing in our, you know, in our minds. And then they get reinforced societally, economically, all that kind of thing. And then, of course, there's I think there's different preferences between liberals and conservatives in terms of like preferred cognitive load, or in other words, like how much they like to think about stuff, because there's this desire for simpler explanations and less of a cognitive load among conservatives. It does tend to push them towards a lot of these more prejudiced or restrictive attitudes. I don't know what the solution is there. I don't know. Probably trying to talk about these things as simply as possible is a good idea. I'm not asserting that conservatives are stupid. It's just like a preference thing there.
Well, it seems to dovetail with what I've heard about fear responses. Apparently heightened fear leads to, for lack of a better word, some turtling, which is, again, totally understandable. You know, if you see danger, yeah, let's get undercover. You know, even if it's not like an immediate adrenal danger, you know, that's going to limit your horizons and your focus. I think that so I don't think it's necessarily like there's things about this that are very understandable, but where it tips for me is, okay, that's how you feel. You make your choices, but there's this tipping point where it's like, okay, this is how I feel. So everyone needs to behave this way now. That's where I start to have major problems. I mean, to me, I think there's a lot of gaslighting and benevolent sexism. Like, this is for your own good.
Yeah. I mean, it's not always, it's not always willful, right? A lot of the time people do actually believe in the danger. And I think that's especially when women act like benevolently sexist towards each other. A lot of it is trying to protect each other, which is a good impulse. But it is this whole thing of like imposing it on other people, right, is the issue.
I think also when religion comes into it, things can get really complicated, because if someone doesn't want to have an abortion for their religious reasons, I'm pro-choice. But I've had people say, you know, this is something we need to protect people from, so that, you know, we need to protect people's souls and this and that. And well, what about people who don't participate in that aspect of your definition? Or in media, we talk about the decades of work that went into what we now know as Fox News and OAN. And there's explicit stuff from people who worked on that about what their goals were, including some of their political goals. And I'm curious if some of the leadership overlaps with what we've seen on the media side, it how deliberate it is. This didn't happen overnight. When as a reporter covering these movements, it was I got assigned to a lot of coverage of this, and I found myself very sensitive to the language and the imagery at some of these events. I think that's part of why I didn't see some of this happening, even as a reporter on the ground whose colleagues were seeing these bills go into effect and hearing these arguments. The language threw me. It's always care. It's always protection. It's always...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, that language is designed to throw you, right? Benevolent sexism is less shocking to a lot of people, especially women, than hostile sexism is, right? And there's actually some evidence that women are less likely to take action against sexism if it's couched in benevolent terms, right?
I had one last question for each of you, which is, what further research, having like read this paper and discussed it, would you want to see from this field?
Honestly, I'd love to see a replication in the United States. Would be huge. I mean, that's like a very specific request. I don't think one's been done, but there is a possibility I've missed it. Replication of this sort of thing in the United States, and also a replication of the second study here on a larger sample, also a larger sample in the US would be great. I'd also like to see some more literature on opinion change around the abortion issue, like how opinions can be changed among people who are anti-choice, and also among people who are, this is something I didn't get a chance to address a lot, but there are a fair number of people who are not completely pro-choice, but who are also not completely anti-choice. And it'd be interesting to see some opportunities for opinion change there too. Mm-hmm. Or not even necessarily full opinion change, but, you know, getting people to start voting on the other side of the issue, right? I think that would be really interesting. So like that's sort of the main thing I'd be interested in looking at there from that field.
Can I ask, like, how long it takes to kind of to do a survey like this? Because I think building off of that, I think it'd be really, really interesting to find out what's changed since last summer. We have.
I mean, that's a surprisingly complicated question. So if you're like piggybacking off of like a national survey or like a panel survey that's already happening. If you had like an unlimited amount of money, if you have the right contacts, you could get it out pretty quickly. You just need to design it and then get it through to whatever the next appropriate round of something from one of these national surveys or something like Pew Research would be. So that, I don't know, a couple months. If you have to build your sample from scratch, that is incredibly expensive and incredibly labor intensive. It also depends how demographically varied you want your survey to be, what compensations you want to have, how much compensation for people who are harder to reach do you need to oversample? You know, younger people don't pick up the phone. Conservatives are maybe less likely to answer surveys, that kind of thing. So you have to compensate for that. I only really have personal experience on, I'm currently finishing up a job where I'm doing data collection for a social science survey about climate issues. For that one, we needed very specific participants in very specific roles. So that's extra difficult. But to get a couple hundred participants, our data collection period, not even like our designing our outreach, figuring out how to do the data collection, which takes months on its own, was probably 3 months at least. And that's for a couple hundred. So it really depends what resources you have at your disposal, how long these things are going to take. And like, so what I'm saying is, like, if you're inside of an organization like Pew Research or like maybe NORC, that's the North American Research Council, I think, like if you're inside one of those organizations or you have a lot of money to give to one of those organizations, your timeline is a couple months. Probably. If you're an independent researcher, oh my God, I hope you can get some grant money.
So before we go, Abby, you have a YouTube channel. Would you like to take a second to plug that?
So I run a YouTube channel called Political Psych with Abby. If you've liked what I talked about here, you're probably going to like that. That one also has visuals and more jokes and that kind of thing. My next video, which might be out by the time this podcast comes out, is actually going to be a more fun one. I'm doing it about the political psychology of 1776, the musical, which if you haven't seen is an amazing musical and shockingly radical. Richard Nixon doesn't want you to see it or doesn't want you to see it in its entirety. You'll have to watch the podcast or Google the, I think, LA Times article about it to find out why. So yeah, you can check that out. And I also have social media things. Those will probably be in the description.
Yes. Yeah. I will link the channel and social medias in the description. Rebecca, do you have anything to plug, any social media?
Can I be super cheesy and say, like, if people found this, I hope people found this interesting and yeah, go. Oh, gosh. Do your own research has become a loaded term. I guess I can't say that.
Do your own research from properly peer reviewed sources.
And I don't know. Try to think about, as a reporter, try to think about the people in these articles. You know, they're not abstract. This woman who's suing KU Med, this is not abstract for her. Her life's changed significantly. So if we can try to remember that, I don't know. That's what I'd like to plug. These are real people.
And I'm going to plug donating to abortion funds. If you are all gonna assume that a lot of my listeners are probably already on the pro-choice side of this issue. So if you are and you have funds to spare, donate to abortion funds. They help people travel to get abortions, since now we have a patchwork of states where it's legal, states where it's not legal. So yes, donate to your local abortion fund and help people out who need to travel to get abortions, because it's gotten significantly more difficult since last year. And with that, we have been discussing the paper, Benevolent Sexism, Attitudes Towards Motherhood and Reproductive Rights, a Multi-Study Longitudinal Examination of Abortion Attitudes by Yanshu Wang et al. And we've been discussing that with our wonderful expert, Abby, from Political Psych with Abby, and our guest, Rebecca. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats.
As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at plainenglishsci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.